Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Barlingham Barrett. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'm joined by my good friend, Manny Barling. Manny, hello.
Hey, Simon, how are you doing? And hello to everybody out there adjusting to daylight savings time.
Well, that's a great lead-in. I was excited to jump out of bed this morning that clocks had changed. So for the first time in 6 months, my digital watch was showing the correct time.
You know, it's amazing. I have about, I think it's 82 clocks around my house. And some of them are gifts, some of them are like sprinkler timers, you know, all those different things. And I was actually surprised how many of them I forgot to change last time.
I have big fingers and a small watch. And the small watch has even smaller little buttons on it. So for at least the past 3 years, I've just learned to live with the fact that for 6 months of the year, the time is an hour off.
Well, we should introduce our guests and see how they're coping with it. Today we're privileged to have Nancy Brancato back, a local developer, lives in Westlake, California, which is on the outskirts of Los Angeles, who's very active in teacher events and affairs. And we also have Peter Haven, who's joined us before also. And we really wanted to talk about schools again and talk about why we're having so many problems, particularly here in Los Angeles, with teachers being removed, what I call late investigations, and really a slew of other issues, which I know they're dying to opine on. But first, I'm dying to hear how they and their respective families are dealing with the issues with the time change. Was it easy for you guys, or should I say, was it good for you?
I don't like the clocks changing at all. I prefer that they just stay, pick a time and keep it this way. Everyone's on the same time. It's very hard to readjust even to that 1 hour.
Yeah, I agree. And as you know, I have Crohn's disease, and there's absolutely nothing worse for me than time changes.
It throws your whole system off, really, and you kind of feel like you're out of sorts for for me now, it seems the older you get, the harder it is to adjust. It takes about a week to adjust.
I agree. Peter, do you have children that are affected by it at all?
You know, all I was thinking about is the fact that all I have are mobile devices and laptops, and they adjust automatically. So for me, I don't even know what time it is unless they tell me what time it is. So I barely noticed, I'm sorry to say. These are my children, these electronic devices. So, for me, it wasn't that much of a change. I did wake up a little. It seemed like a little bit earlier this morning, but that was about it.
You know, Peter, on behalf of all of us who have children, we all consider you very fortunate.
I guess the grass is always greener because I see it the other way, but there you go.
I'll lend you mine for a while, and I'll end this with this story. My best friend, who Nancy knows, back in the 70s, was marrying a lady who really wanted to have children. And my ex-wife and I decided we were going on one of our little driving trips, and we took off in the car, and we drove around the Western United States and through Canada, Simon, just to get away, because there's no phones in Western Canada, particularly in those times, so anyone could find me. But I got back, and my best friend is so angry, he doesn't really even want to talk to me. I'm going, what's this all about? So it took him a few days to calm down. So the next thing I hear is his girlfriend calls me and says, you know, man, I made a decision. I'm not going to have any children. I said, why are you not going to have any children? He said, well, you know, 2 weeks with your children was enough to convince me I didn't want to be a mother.
Oh, my
gosh. So I wish my children were listening. Their ears would be. But, you know, the truth was my children were proud of it.
Oh, kids, you can't live with them and you can't live without them, right?
Well, they're easier for parents than strangers. You know, and to finish the story, because it really happens with lawyers, because lawyers, because of their personality and the way they raise children, their children are a little different than other ones. So my ex-wife and I went away. I think we were in Tahoe somewhere, and we left them with a babysitter, and the only one we could find was somewhat elderly. Well, we get this phone call from her. Your children are so difficult. They're blah, 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 blah. And I talk to kids and go, come on, guys. We'll be back in 4 or 5 days. Could you just let up on her? So sure enough, I get a call from her, and she says, your children have fired me. I said, what do you mean? Wait a minute. My children have fired you? And she goes, your children fired me. And I went, you know, what do you mean they fired me? She says, well, they showed up. They paid me what I was owed and told me I should leave. And I said, I can't leave without your parents' permission. So, you know, I get them on the phone. And sure enough, they went to the bank, took some money out of their savings account, and told her she was fired and got rid of her.
Oh, my gosh.
So my ex-wife and I finally said, okay, we'll be home in about 4 days, for God's sakes. It was summertime. You know, and I think he was about 12 or 13, and she was about 8. So, I have a lot of other friends who, lawyers with children, have the same problem. Where they're children, because they just get too strong and independent. So anyway, guys, enough children's stories, at least of mine.
Yeah, I won't discuss mine.
You see what I? You see, right? Already where this is going with children?
Oh, okay. Well, let's talk about schools. Manny, I'll let you kick it off.
Well, I was somewhat bothered by what I see as an institutional problem, and we're going to start with two problems and probably start in the Orange County area. For people who don't live in the Los Angeles area, Los Angeles is greater Los Angeles includes Orange County, and collectively they're just under 15 million, about 5 million in Orange County, and almost 10 million in L.A. County, but really only 3.5-4 million live in the city of L.A., and there's 88 incorporated cities and about, oh, I don't know, about 15, 16 ones that aren't incorporated. Famous cities like Malibu, Beverly Hills, Pasadena, Santa Monica are not part of L.A. City. So the number in L.A. City is 45,473 teachers. When we go to Orange County, I don't have a number there, but we've had two problems again. The first one is a sexual assault and a public library near a school, which is populated primarily by children after school, and a school in the North San Fernando Valley. So we're going to start with Orange County, and it's a city called Irvine near famous Newport Beach and Balboa Island. And what happened is Friday, a young child, I think he was somewhere about 9 or 10, ran to the police department and said he was sexually assaulted. And before they could do anything, apparently there was a policeman going by the library, and some guy came out and walked up to the cop and said, I think you're looking for me. And the guy says, why? He says, well, because I sexually molested a child. The molester, you know, and the assaulter was so certain the police were looking for him already, he basically confessed. And it turned out he was 23 years old, had a long history of this, was already labeled what's called a mentally disordered sex offender, which is an MDSO, and required to register everywhere he went. But yet, here he was hanging around a public library with no supervision and no one dealing with what I would call a lurking male looking at children. And, you know, and I know I'm going to pass this one to Nancy, who is a mother, is always distressed about where children were and who were around them. And Nancy, tell us a little story about what you said earlier about the difference between your children going to school in a small town in New Jersey and what you've experienced here in Los Angeles.
Well, my daughter would have been in a high school in New Jersey of a total of 200 children, as opposed to out here when she was a freshman in Calabasas High School, there was about 2,500 children there. And it's really kind of hard for the teachers to know exactly which kids belong and which kids don't. I had a situation where she was missing. I reported it to the police. I reported it to the school system. And a couple of days had gone by, and, of course, I was frantic. I didn't know if she had just voluntarily left or she was being held somewhere against her will. And it turned out that she had been in a class at the high school that was not hers. She was not registered in the class. she was there with another student, and the teacher didn't even say anything to her, like, what's your name and what are you doing in my class? And it turned out that the administration never even bothered telling the other teachers on the campus that she had been missing, and if anybody, you know, should see her or they should contact the police or anything else. Nobody knew anything about it, and I was really very upset with that. And I was basically told, with 2,500 children on the school campus, you can't possibly expect the teachers here to know every one of them by name and if they should be here, if they go to a different school or whatever the case may be. And I just felt that was not an acceptable answer to my situation. I was very upset.
Peter, I have to ask you, from a legal perspective, there is a limit to the number of kids, in a classroom. It might be 30. Probably today it's more like 40. But don't you think, a teacher would at least recognize the kids in his his or her classroom?
I think without question that teachers who teach classes regularly would clearly be able to identify who are their normal students and if there's some sort of new student. So I don't understand why, if you're teaching a class regularly and you see a new face in there, why you wouldn't be able to put two and two together. It suggests there may be a lot of flow of students in and out of classrooms and or that teachers are being shuttled around and not necessarily teaching classes that they normally teach. Otherwise, I can't imagine how a teacher would not recognize that there was someone in the classroom who wasn't a typical student.
Nancy, that must have gone through your mind.
Well, it was a regular teacher. It wasn't a substitute or anything, and he just didn't care if she was there or not. I think, she knew him just being on campus. He was not a teacher of hers, and he didn't really care whether she was sitting in his class with a friend of hers or not. And when I was in high school, I remember the teachers having to take attendance prior to each class, and there'd be no way that there'd be a kid in that class that didn't belong in that class. The teacher would have said, what are you doing here? You have to leave. You don't belong in my class.
Let me add to that. As I said, I went to private Catholic schools and with nuns, and basically rule number one was the old seating chart. And everybody came in and sat down, and they could look up without asking and know immediately who was missing. And they would immediately, if someone was late from the playground or someone, they'd go, where's Johnny? He's not in his seat. And they knew immediately who was in the class and who wasn't. So it would seem to me that step one for any teacher would be to have a seating chart of your class. I mean, how do you call on people? How do you address your students if you don't do that? It just seems strange to me.
Yeah, it was very strange to me. And like I said, having come from a small town in New Jersey to, a town in a school district where everyone knew everyone. All the parents knew the kids and who they belonged to. And you would know if there was a stranger on your road or at the playground, somebody that wasn't from the area, you would know because it was a small town. To coming out here, it was a total culture shock for me to have a high school now that had 2,500 kids in it, and parents didn't even know their children's friends or their friends, the kids' parents. You didn't know really anything about anybody.
Yeah, that is a problem. Peter, have you seen anything of this in your passing, how this with among your friends since you don't have children, and have they complained about classroom sizes?
I don't really get. I actually have friends who are teachers, and they actually complain about classroom sizes, that, classroom sizes are getting, too big for them to manage and too big for them to handle, and, that they're overwhelmed a lot of the times by, how many people they're in charge of and all the other different you know, responsibilities they have as teachers. I do hear that from friends of mine who do teach.
Yeah, I hear that also. It's really quite a problem right now.
All right, Peter, I'll approach it from a different angle. You're an attorney. You're a well-known attorney. Does it bother you that, you know, this is going on in our public school system? You know, a teacher doesn't know who should or should not be in their class?
Well, it certainly is very disturbing. I always want to hear as many different sides of the story as possible, and I'd want to know exactly what the teacher thought and what the teacher perceived, and I'd want to know if the students had any interaction with him, such as, you know, I'm just sitting here in class or something like that. But, you know, and that's what we try to do whenever we approach a legal issue. We want to get as much information as possible, and a story is all every event is always a tale of at least two different stories, and usually a lot more than that. So we'd want to gather all the points of view that we possibly could, and then start to draw some conclusions from that and see what we could do to fix or repair things. But as a general, just hearing about it, it's obviously a cause for great concern.
I have a theory. It's hardly original. You know, there are three views of every story. There's mine, there's yours, and there's the truth, which lies somewhere in the middle.
Well, yeah, let me tell you a law school story that I'm sure Peter experienced. Or probably didn't in his time, but when I went to law school, they just loved to play this game. And someone, you're for sure, they would have someone run in and they would fire a cap gun or something at the professor and run out. And he would suddenly go, well, what did he look like? What do you remember? What clothes were they wearing? You know, it'd be, you know, 50, 75 kids in the for sure law school. And some of them not kids, really. And they would look at each other, and they would start trying to figure out what they saw and didn't see. And usually, they didn't see much. Did you go through that experience too, Peter?
Very much. We always had little examples that were like that. And I remember as we were, you know, throughout my progression in law, and it started in law school, but even probably a little bit before then, I remember just, you know, we used to do things where we would run tests and we would tell people to say something, and we have about 10 people lined up and they were asked to say something, and it was one of those pass it on situations. And the test was what was the phrase at the beginning of the pass it on sequence and what did it become by the end of the pass it on sequence. And, you know, it would invariably get changed or shortened or garbled or completely confused in the transmission of information from one person to the next. And I also remember getting a very definite sense of how, you know, trying to get at the truth. You know, it's very difficult to try to get at the truth, but we have to try as best we can. And it was always a function of looking at everything from multiple different perspectives. You know, right now I'm holding up in front of me, true to form, one of those square mouse pads. And if I look at it from directly on straight ahead, it looks like a perfect square. If I change the angle and I hold it up at eye level, it turns into a thin line. And then if I tilt it slightly at an angle, I can get it to look like, you know, something like a diamond or something from depending upon the point of view. And, you know, we hear different points of view and we think, well, that can't be true. It's a line, it can't be a square, or it's a square, it can't be a diamond. And what we were taught in law school was to try hard to try and understand all these other points of view and see if there was any way we could make them all fit. And the ones you couldn't make fit, more likely than not, those were the ones that weren't true. But there were a variety of exercises and examples that, you know, you go through in this process, trying to learn this technique of trying to see if you can get understand what really happened, what the event really told as it unfolded.
Okay. Yeah.
So you're doubting what I'm telling you as far as the teacher not saying anything about my daughter being in the class that she wasn't registered for?
No. We're talking about events that multiple people observe. For example, if you walked in to the class to talk to the teacher and someone walked in and shot the teacher, then everybody in the class would have a different viewpoint.
Right, of course. Well, everyone sees it differently.
Right, but we're not talking about an individual act where someone goes in with a calculated reason, as you did, to discover where your child is, and then those efforts are thwarted through some communication. Those are, you know, planned moments, and people usually are able to recall them with very specific, exact detail, as opposed to what Peter's describing, where, you know, it's a pass-on or some other situation.
It's the game telephone that the kids play.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, by the way, it's one of the things that concerns us in investigations, and the classic example would be your child is reported to the office for some perceived wrong, and by the time the teacher's story gets floated around, it's no longer what really happened. And that's also what Peter's talking about, is that story changes, and especially on the schoolyard or, you know, that old line about they're, you know, it starts out, there are 50 troops coming, and then, you know, 5 miles down the line, it comes across as there's 5,000, and they're all got big guns. And I just, go ahead.
Nancy, I don't want to, dredge up, you know, old pains or open up old war wounds, but you must have been completely,
angry, pissed off would be the word.
Right. I was trying to find words that, wouldn't offend listeners. Your daughter was 15. I believe that the story is she was hanging out with an older guy.
Yes.
You must have been so frustrated. You know, the kid isn't at home. She's missing, and you're getting no help from the school system. Did you get any help at all from the police system?
No, I didn't get any help from anybody. I had to hire a private investigator and security firm in order to find my daughter, because the police told me they were too busy. They didn't have the time or the resources to look for missing kids. And the school system, I don't understand why they couldn't even make an announcement to the teachers at the school. They told me that they had decided not to make an announcement to the teachers or the other students that she was even missing. And I don't know why they made that call, but I was really very upset, needless to say, when I found out she was in a class for the entire 45, 50 minutes of the class, and nobody ever reported it, and the school never called me. That would have been a perfect situation for me to go up there and recover my daughter or have the police go up there and do it, but I wasn't even made aware that she was there until it was too late, and the class was over, and she had been long gone. But I didn't get any help from anybody to find my daughter, and I was very upset by it.
Yeah, I have to unleash the lawyers. Peter.
Well, if you're fortunate, or the school system's fortunate, that she did not suffer any harm from anything, because then you get into a lack of supervision issue. Don't you feel the same way, Peter?
Well, all I can think is, we're so lucky, and it, from what I can gather from this incident, is that nothing horrible happened. It's traumatic to go through in and of itself, but it's even more traumatic when there's a horrible outcome at the end of the day. And I'm just grateful that nothing was wrong. But it is unfortunate that the system, you know, doesn't respond more readily to this sort of thing and have a better line of communication.
Well, let's get to my pet peeve. What do they put into schools in terms of systems and things to stop or prevent this? And how do some of these decisions get made? I want to move over to even this North Hills incident, where on March 1st they basically notified parents through the mail that a teacher, kindergarten teacher, was removed from the Lassen Elementary School, which is in North Hills, which is next to the 405 freeway, leaving the San Fernando Valley, going to Palm Springs and, I should say, San Francisco and all points north. So they remove this guy. They don't tell why. Here's the letter. It says simply, "This letter is to inform you that an allegation is made of an inappropriate behavior involving a staff member." Well, it turns out that it had been inappropriate touching from what the reporters could discover. And this is, quote, "Upon receiving the information, the proper authorities were notified. As part of the investigation, the employee has been temporarily removed from the school, but nobody was arrested, so he's in the rubber room, you know, where all teachers go who get paid who don't do anything. But what's disturbing to me, Nancy and Peter, is it turns out that this was not the first complaint, that they'd investigated one or two others about 10 years ago. And I don't know this one or two others because my friends in the press tell me that the L.A. Unified School District has lost all that investigation and no one knows the specifics, nor apparently did the principal now at the school know that he'd been investigated previously. So, you know, isn't that incredible?
I hear stories about court records and investigative records being lost all the time. And, you know, it always amazes me when it does. But I can tell you, I'm sorry to say, it happens. It's not frequent by any stretch of the imagination, but it does happen. And when you're talking about older records, 10 plus years, it does happen more frequently than you would want or expect, and there's literally no explanation for it other than there's just a massive amount of information and it doesn't get handled properly.
Well, I agree and I disagree, Peter. I mean, you and I are used to records being misplaced in Los Angeles Superior Court for a variety of reasons, lack of personnel, the huge volume of documents. I know you've been down in the dungeon under the parking lot.
Yes, I was just thinking about that. I don't know if many people have really had that experience. It's quite an amazing thing to go deep into the bowels of the L.A. Superior Court system and see all those records.
And I want you to know it's better than when I was a young lawyer because they were really in the bowels. This is a much improved, moved up, more user-friendly than it used to be. I mean, it was really awful. And it's hard sometimes to locate documents, old files, cases, and a variety of other things like that. So at the end of the day, that's always been a problem. But when you get to schools, and there's far less number of complaints, far less paperwork, and friends of mine in the other school districts just shake their head when they hear stories. I called my friend at another school district and asked her what she felt about it, and she said, well, you know, that's L.A. Unified School District. You know, you never know what they have and they don't have, and she just kind of dealt like it. Well, you know, L.A. is unique. They just make messes, and this is the typical mess that they have. And I thought that was kind of strange that even among the other school districts, they have a bad reputation for it.
Well, do you think they deliberately lost those records?
Well, no. Those of us who've dealt with the school district over any period of time just think they're grossly incompetent.
That's what I would think. What's interesting to me is even though the records were lost, apparently someone still knew about the prior investigations and the prior allegations.
Right.
And I'm curious as to how and who people had that information. But, you know, obviously someone was aware of it, even though the records themselves were lost.
Well, I think those are matters that are extremely difficult to hide from people who may be around during that particular time period, who may have even, other teachers who may have even had strong feelings about an individual teacher that they weren't sure about them. Because I believe that other teachers know about other teachers. I don't care what they say. You know, my experiences are people as bright as all that know when something isn't right. They can see it, or they see a personality in the school system that they don't feel comfortable with, a fellow teacher who's maybe quiet, withdrawn, and shows unusual tendencies. And I just don't think it's as big a secret among other teachers. So I wouldn't be surprised if one of the other teachers blew the whistle.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I tend to agree. I think the people who are in regular interaction with these other teachers know or suspect something, and then that leads to a whole other layer of inquiry. What are these associates and colleagues doing, if anything, to monitor this type of behavior?
Yeah, and are other teachers so frustrated that they feel they can't comment, or it's dangerous for them to comment? So I oftentimes wonder about that. And teachers, as we all know, are notoriously withdrawn from this. They're afraid of being criticized, and frankly, I find teachers as a whole not to be the strongest group in defending their rights. So I'm not surprised.
Well, you know, I'm going to support teachers. They are doing a great job 99% of the time. That there's just this, you know, 1% that you don't like. It's akin to the Hell's Angels. You know, lots of people have motorbikes, but you know, most people that have motorbikes don't deal drugs and kill people.
Well, Simon, I think a better example is my profession. What does a lawyer do when he discovers some type of gross misconduct that may be even actionable under the bar rules? I mean, you know, what does he say? Who does he say it to? What are the consequences of him making a report? And I think that's pervasive in every industry. We see it most commonly among police. You know, the alleged code of silence. Are police willing to report other police, for example? That's an issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ooh, it's a big issue.
So my point is, this is basically a very big issue among every group of people that have some obligation or must consider that their job requires them to report conduct. And that's what disturbs me is, and if we picked up this question 5 years from now, I think it would be the same issue. Don't you, Peter?
Yeah, I do. There's one thing that's unique about teachers. What's generally true across every industry, in my opinion, is that you get a certain percentage of bad apples, whatever it might be. But teaching and anything involving children is going to attract a lot of people who have what I would describe good motivations and proper motivations. They genuinely want to help kids. And it's always also going to attract a certain percentage of people who have really ulterior motives and are drawn to it for ulterior reasons. And the system has to be aware of that predilection, if you will. And it has to do what it can to self-monitor it, because it's a unique sector that's going to attract these types of individuals. Having said that, I think they are aware that they have to be mindful of that. I obviously they're having difficulties, grappling with all of that.
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons why I started out by giving the numbers. So we've got 45,473 teachers. We know of three recently that have been removed because of these allegations. We know their number in the rubber room, but it's less than 1%. But when you talk about doctors and you talk about, police and other public officials whose impact is so great in our society every day, then the margin of error, everybody would like to be zero. And I just think human nature makes that number impossible, but as well as we're doing it, the flaws that we have are not the kind of flaws you would expect, right? I mean, you would expect some form of ultimate deceit to avoid detection, but it doesn't take ultimate deceit. They just get up and do this, and nobody notices because they're not putting out a large enough effort. And I don't know that you disagree with that, but I really think that's a big issue, is that the crimes and issues that we're catching should be ones that are easily caught. Don't you agree?
I think when the behavior is fairly obvious, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's just no doubt about that. And yet the problem still exists, and, you know, who knows how we...
Yeah. All right, Nancy, let's bring you back into the conversation.
Well, teachers are in a little bit of a unique position, because they're one adult in a classroom of 20 or 30 children. So they really aren't being watched by anybody but kids. So it's not like a different profession where you'd have another adult coworker right in the next cubicle next to you, or right in the same area or office as you would be. Teachers are pretty much out there doing their own thing in a classroom with just children. They're not being monitored. So I'm sure that when they're with their peers, they're acting in a totally acceptable fashion. And the couple of teachers that are, you know, pedophiles or, you know, bad people, whatever, are doing whatever they're doing when there are no other adults present. They're not behaving in engaging in behavior that is detrimental to children with another adult there. They're not being monitored that closely.
A couple of years ago, I was invited to the local high school to talk about some Civil War stuff. It was a history class, and that teacher...
Well, excuse me, didn't anybody hear your accent? Now I'm getting worried about that school system. They're bringing in... So what was your take, that you should not have lost the Revolutionary War?
I thought he said the Civil War, but...
the bottom line was, the teacher knew every person in the class, and that there were probably 25 kids, and, you know, that they were called out by name. I mean, that there were no kids sneaking in. I mean, it was teacher that understood and, you know, had great respect for, you know, the children. How can a child sneak into a class?
Well, that's interesting. You know, you can do it in law school and you can do it in college. I have a friend of mine who went to UCLA and eventually left because of classes. He had 387 students in his freshman chemistry class. I had, I think, 22 in my freshman class at USC, and two of us left and took a different course because we realized that it wasn't as easy as high school chemistry. But when you get down to the lower grades, that impact becomes even more difficult. I also think the younger the grades, the harder it is to keep track of the names and stuff of the children. And by the younger the grades, I'm talking about kindergarten through probably second grade. Yeah, we'll think about it for a moment. You think about how, first of all, the kids change a lot, and it takes a little while to identify all of them visually, and then they change and keep changing, and they aren't as verbal and speak as much as children by the fourth or fifth grade. So I think there's it takes a little more time to do it when they're younger, but still there's no excuse for not doing it.
Right. I mean, Nancy, you must have been horrified. Your child is going to school but not going to the right class, and no one could care. No one's keeping track of it.
No, I was horrified. I actually took her out of Calabasas High School right after that and put her in Louisville. So
Louisville, small Catholic high school about a mile away.
It's all girls. and all girls.
I remember.
But, yeah, like I said, in New Jersey, that never would have happened. There would never have been a situation where a high school student would be sitting in a class that he or she was not assigned to, and it would just have been left, you know, okay, this is fine for this to have happened. The teacher did know she was in the class and didn't care. It didn't question it. It wasn't like she was hiding under a desk or anything. She was there in plain sight. And he said, even after the fact, he said he knew that she was sitting there, but he just figured she was with her friend, and he didn't really ask any questions. So, which is really kind of very alarming to me. I think these teachers really should have more control over their classrooms and know who belongs there and who doesn't. If there's a child sitting in your classroom that is not assigned to your class, there's a reason why the student is there. They should be somewhere else, shouldn't they? I mean, they're of high school age, and if they don't have you for a teacher during that subject or that time slot, they're obviously skipping out on the teacher they're supposed to be, you know, at that classroom. So that's why didn't this teacher even think, well, where does this child belong? She certainly doesn't belong in my class, but she's a high school student. She belongs in somebody else's class, and she's sitting here. But they didn't.
Well, you know, in all fairness, this is a guy who recognized it. He just did nothing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
what happened. He recognized that she was there. She didn't. He knew she was not one of his students. He even knew her name, but didn't say, like, where do you belong? You don't belong here. You have another class. It's the middle of the school day. You should be in the class that you're assigned to. He didn't say anything. But
I find that alarming, too.
I know. And then that's just the, you know, the most alarming thing was that the school administration there didn't find it, you know, I guess reasonable to alert all the teachers and the students on the campus that she was missing and she was reported as a missing person. They didn't even notify the staff. So, I mean, that was the principal's call.
Peter, you must be absolutely horrified at this.
Well, let me, if I may, and I apologize if I didn't understand earlier the complete fact pattern here, but I just want to see if I can clear up a few things. Now, Nancy, you said she didn't go to her class; she went to another class. Why did she go to another class instead of going to her class?
You know, I don't know. She was missing, and I didn't know if she was missing, you know, voluntarily, like she had run away or she had been taken against her will. I didn't know at that point what had happened to her. I reported her to the police. She was, you know, categorized as a missing person. She was a student at Calabasas High School, but she was not in her class. I did call the school, and I told the school that she was missing. And if they saw her on the campus or if she did show up at school, to please notify me and the police, because the police had her as a missing person. And they assured me that they would tell all the teachers and the staff, and they would notify me if something, you know, someone should see her on the campus, which they did not. Now, I don't know why she chose to go to the school campus while she was obviously at the end of it. I found out she had run away with this older boyfriend, that she was 15 and he was 19, and she just left with him. But she went to school for some reason on a day that school was in session and showed up in a class that she was not registered for with a friend of hers. I don't know. I don't know why she decided to do that as opposed to just going to her own class, except for the fact that maybe she would have thought I reported it to the school and maybe her own teacher would have been notified and then the police
would
have...
And how long had she been, in your mind, missing, and when did you make the report to the police?
Well, I notified the police the next day, as soon as she didn't come home the night before, and this was probably on day 4 or 5 that she was missing, that she was at the school. And I called the school right away. Monday morning when they opened, I called the school and told them that she had been missing for 3 days. It was 3 or 4 days by then. It was right around Thanksgiving. And I told the principal that, you know, I reported to the police, and the police notify the police or myself or both of us if she should come to school.
Well, it's pretty shocking. It sounds to me like the school had 4 or 5 days notice from you that she was missing, and there doesn't seem to have been any kind of school-wide dissemination of information regarding this.
No, there wasn't.
And pardon me?
There was not. The principal told me, because you know I was furious when I found this out, and I went up to the school and I was trying to talk with the principal, and he told me that, I said, why didn't the teacher notify anybody? And he said, well, he had decided against giving out this information to the students and the staff. So he never...
I don't know what their reason was for doing that, but I don't obviously agree with it, but I don't know what their motivation could have been. They'd probably say something like, these kinds of things happen frequently, but that's about all I could imagine them saying. So it's shocking that all the students, all the faculty didn't know that she was missing. So if I understand correctly, when this teacher saw your daughter in his class, he didn't know at that time that she was reported missing.
No, he didn't.
So,
but he did know she was not his student.
Yeah, he obviously knew that, and I guess there was some exchange between this teacher and your daughter at the time. It sounds to me like they did have some interaction, at least at a bare minimum. He said, what are you doing in this class?
That's possible.
And at the time, it sounds like she was trying to avoid being detected by you.
Yes, she was.
Yeah. So it's shocking that the school doesn't disseminate this information to all teachers. It sounds to me like your daughter, for reasons that she decided she wanted to get away for a while. I don't think that's uncommon for young people to feel that way sometimes. I think she's trying to avoid being detected by you, but school is a social community, and a lot of these students feel connected to it in one way or another. So for whatever reason, she wanted to go back and be in school, and she now... materializes in this classroom with this teacher who knows that she's not normally in his class, but he doesn't know that she's a missing person, and he doesn't see any signs that she's in any kind of duress or anything like that. And I don't know what she said to him or what was said to him at that time to alleviate whatever concern he may have had about her being in that class. The really shocking thing, or at least the most important thing, it seems to me, is that the school, upon 4 or 5 days advance notice that your daughter was missing, didn't see fit to take more aggressive action regarding her status. And I don't know why they did that. I don't know why they did that.
Well, let me ask you a thought as a parent, even though my kids have been away from school for a long time. Schools are one step away from being a prison in the way that they're operated. And for better or worse, it's done because of the awesome responsibility of taking care of someone else's child. And in that responsibility, you know, teachers are forced to weigh decisions that are different than the average person makes. And the minute one child is not where they're supposed to be is literally a red flag in a school system. And there's, as a parent, to me, there are so many red flags in this conversation. All I can do is shake my head, because I can tell you that if my child were missing and the school did that to me, they would have to hide, because I would not react to that particularly well. And perhaps, that raises the other question. If you were a lawyer, Nancy, or your lawyer walked in and threatened him, would they react differently because of their fear?
I'm sure they would have.
There's a lot of issues in here that really bring me to pause over what motivates the school system and when do they act and what causes them to act. And that really bothers me. Oh, a mother comes and complains about their child. Let's move on. A lawyer comes in, or a father who's a lawyer comes in, or someone else with a, and they may take a different action. But it's the inconsistency of the action that bothers me so much. Why is that a reason for making a decision about what you do with a child? And that therein lies the real question. Why are they making decisions on an ad hoc basis as opposed to having a very disciplined procedure that would resolve these problems that all parents are concerned about? And that's what you're upset about, right, Nancy?
Well, yes, I was very upset by that and the fact that they didn't seem to care about her at all. I mean, why couldn't they at least tell the staff that she was missing? I mean, every one of those teachers on that campus should have been aware that she was missing, and they should have given out a picture of her. They have a picture in her file, and they have her name. All they would have had to do was make an announcement to the teachers and tell them this child has been reported missing. If she should, turn up on the campus, if anybody should see her, please, contact her mother or the police or both or whatever. But nothing was done. They took zero action on it. And, of course, when I found out it was too late because she had already left the school campus by then. So she was missing a couple of days beyond this point, whereas I could have had her, safely at home. She was still out roaming Los Angeles County for a couple of days after this because the school principal decided not to let this faculty or the student population know that she was missing.
Oh, and did they ever give you any explanation for why they did that? Because I agree that's pretty amazing to me.
They didn't want to alarm anybody.
Perfect.
They didn't really want to, upset people and alarm the kids, and they didn't know what the situation was. They're just a bunch of nonsense.
It's a good thing there wasn't a fire. They might not have thought that was important enough to notify someone.
Yeah, it just seems to me that in a lot of cases, and be it with these sexually deviant teachers or whatever the case may be, in school systems, a lot of things get swept under the rug, and they don't want to deal with them. They don't want to get involved or whatever the case may be. Maybe they think they're overworked and underpaid, and they just don't want to have any more responsibility than they have. But they don't seem to be that engaged in what's happening on their campuses. It's a shame.
I want to come back to something Peter said. Peter, you live in the South Bay, and I know where you live very well. I know your area very well. And I know how parents are in your area because I have a lot of friends who live there. But the area that she's talking about is a very quiet area of San Fernando Valley where a child who isn't around is really a big issue. It's not an area where children run loose or whatever. And, yes, children do decide to leave home for a variety of different reasons. But it's so rare in our neighborhood that a child takes off like that for whatever their reasons. And in Nancy's case, she'd relocated from the East Coast. Her daughter wasn't happy with school. And there are a lot of motivating factors. But those major motivating factors, to me, are the reason why you push the panic button. So I have a young lady who moved from the East Coast who's not happy in her surroundings, and she's now elected not to show up for school. Wouldn't that push bells for all of us?
Well, it's very interesting. Yes, it would. And the big decision here is to set off the alarm bell, and they specifically say, according to what Nancy says, is they didn't want to alarm anybody.
Yeah.
So they specifically didn't want to set off the alarm bell. And, hearing that, what it's apparent that they're saying is that they believe this is not a serious situation. That's when they say we don't want to alarm anybody, they're saying we don't believe this is a serious situation. That's what they're saying. And I just have no idea why they would take that position. But that when they tell you, we didn't want to alarm anyone, what they're saying is we didn't think this was serious.
That's a good point.
I had the Fairhaven, New Jersey Police Department helping me more than anybody out here in the Los Angeles, Calabasas area. Then it was everyone in New Jersey where we had moved from. It was a small town. I called the police there. I knew many of them personally, and they were looking for my daughter. They had the time, but the people out here didn't have the time and didn't see any urgency in the situation. And I just think it might go back to the whole difference in the way the kids are raised out in the Los Angeles area as opposed to a small town on the East Coast. There's less.
I think that's very unfair.
Well, unfair or not, that's the way I see it. It's like a lot of the parents here, when my daughter was, when we first moved here and she was 14, I would have some of the moms dropping their daughters off for sleepovers, and they would drop them off Friday after school. They never came in to meet me. They didn't know who I was, and 3 days go by, and it's Sunday evening, and the kid is still at my house without a word from the parent. That never would have happened where I moved from, never. And it just seemed like they were more involved, the parents were more involved in their own social lives and more concerned with where they were going and really didn't watch over their children as much as what the, you know, where I moved from. It was a very small community, and the parents watched out for each other's kids. And, you know, if you called and you said your kid was missing, everyone would have been out looking for your child, as opposed to everyone's attitude in the Calabasas area was, oh, it's no big deal.
Wow. I can't imagine that.
Yeah. That actually reminds me of a story. I moved to San Diego, and I think my kids were, something like 5 and 7 years old, and you know, we had to go to the school to register them. And, you know, we were used to, kids coming home for school, coming home for lunch. And I asked the nice lady, so how does this work? You know, do the kids come home for lunch? And she looked at me, laughed, and said, good Lord, no. I mean, half of them wouldn't come back in the afternoon.
Yeah, right.
Is that because they were fed pink slime?
Could be.
I don't know if they had pink slime back then. I think that's a new thing.
Yeah, it's only a couple of years. And in fact, you might recall in one of my books, it's been a pet peeve for Ashley, my wife, who's my co-author in a number of books. And Nancy, that is definitely one of the things, as you know, that just drives her crazy, is that they use this pink slime in food and then give it to children. And we're just absolutely amazed. If you ever see the movie Food, Inc., they interviewed the guy who invented it and how proud he is of making bleach that fits inside of your meals every day. It's just amazing.
Oh, gosh. Gross.
Yep.
Well, that's the topic of another expose. What we feed our kids in school, that's probably just as scathing.
Yes. I've written 4 scathing books on that subject, just a matter of fact. Right, Simon?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's amazing. And we'll do another show. And for all we know, that's what's happening to children in L.A. They're being driven nuts by the chemicals in the food they feed them in school.
I think there's probably a lot to that. I really do.
Yeah, it certainly has contributed to other problems. Go ahead, Simon.
But moving on, let's talk about another subject, the whole Sandusky thing. As I understand it, that there's going to be a hearing tomorrow about what and what should not be released. Many I well, Manny and Peter, you're the experts. You're the lawyers. I mean, this case is turning into a real nightmare.
Well, all of these sensationalized cases are, you know, they always say bad facts make bad law. In this case, what we have is a classic balancing of interests, the privacy interests of the people who may be assaulted by him versus the interests in the Constitution to provide everybody a fair trial. And it's very hard to balance. Some of the issues were resolved earlier in the week when basically what happened is they agreed that of the individuals who may be potentially witnesses, they will provide all of that information. I believe it's 10 days before the first witness is called, but they said specifically, but not 10 days before jury selection. Well, the difference in time between jury selection and starting trial sometimes is such a short period of time that I really don't know how that time really differentiates. Peter, do you feel any differently about that?
The difference in what time now? The difference
between...
Well,
they're saying that a difference between providing something the day you start your jury selection versus the day the first witness is called, so 10 days before either event. But the difference in time between starting to impanel a jury and calling your first witness sometimes is less than a week in some courts.
Absolutely. It's a very short period of time, and in a case like this, you may have a longer time picking a jury, but in most instances, my experience is you only take about a day or two to get a jury. In this case, it might take a little bit longer, but you're typically talking about a week or less.
Yeah. In fact, a lot of judges, as you well know, impose time restrictions on you. They give you specific amount of time to get your jury impaneled, or they start clamping down on you and eliminating the types of questions you get asked to pressure you to take the jury that's in front of you.
If you don't pick a jury, they'll pick one for you.
But here's the really big deal. I mean, they're going to share the grand jury testimony. I thought. Grand jury testimony was sacrosanct.
I don't know if anything's sacrosanct in the law anymore, but I think if you're going to charge someone with a crime and you intend to try that person for a crime and you intend to call an individual as a witness, you cannot hide information that could be exculpatory. And recently, as in the last few days, some people may have read in the news that former Senator Ted Stevens, who was killed in the tragic airplane accident, was recently exonerated by the Justice Department because it turns out the prosecution team had withheld valuable evidence that could have exculpated him from the crime. I must tell you, among lawyers, that's a pretty upsetting situation, because to try a case where the prosecutors fail to give you documents that you feel can have your client dismissed or released or found not guilty of a crime is really very, very upsetting. And I think you feel the same way, don't you, Peter? If you had a case like that, you'd be screaming bloody murder, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. It's one of the cardinal rules of criminal prosecution that the prosecutor is essentially supposed to turn over all evidence that could in any way bear upon the innocence or the non-guilt of the defendant. And yet we see over and over again many instances where prosecutors fail to do that. It's not just a failure. They intentionally go out of their way to refrain from doing that. So it sounds like this Sandusky hearing is going to be another wrestling match regarding that issue. But we see it all too often. There was that Duke alleged rape case several years ago, and that prosecutor ended up being disbarred. And, you know, my understanding is that the hearings coming up in Sandusky case is going to be to determine whether or not the prosecutors are required to turn over that information. And at least that's a good sign. They're going through legal process and they're asking the judge, well, do we have to turn this over or not? At least that's better than just hiding it and pretending it's not there.
Well, the prosecution requested to keep the testimony secret until a week or less before the day the trial started, and Sandusky wanted them 30 days, the information 30 days before the start of the trial, and it looks like the judge decided that he's going to get them 10 days before the trial starts.
That is the final ruling, as I understand it.
Yeah.
It will be announced tomorrow. I wouldn't call it a backroom deal, but it was a common sense compromise for everybody.
Well, I don't like Sandusky. I mean, I don't know the man personally, but the things that he's accused of doing.
He should really have access
to the information that they're going to go to court and use against him. He's got a right to defend himself. So he should have.
But Nancy, there's good reason why you wouldn't like him. You're not male. And you're not 5 years old.
True. But I just putting aside what he's charged of doing, because he's supposed to be innocent until proven guilty, but I know most of the people already think he's definitely guilty, but he really should have the right to have the information that he could use to prevent his or to put on his defense. He's entitled to a defense.
Well, you know, I laugh, Simon, because if you've seen the photo they use in the paper of him, I think people could find him guilty just from the photo. I mean, it's a terrible photo. It reeks of a guilty person, a kind of hand-dog look. It's almost like, does anybody really think that an arrest photo, assuming that's what it is going to make anyone look anything other than guilty?
No.
It's typically not catching people at their best moment, that's for sure.
Yeah. Ask Nick Nolte.
Boy, that's a good one. That was coming to mind. That was a terrible one.
Yeah, he can't escape that photo if he wanted to.
My point is, you know, why did people spend so many years waiting to trap Sandusky, you know, or bring Sandusky to trial? I mean, what's wrong with our system?
Well, that's a classic case of small local law, power, and, of course, denial, because, you know, one of the things I find about small towns, having dealt with a lot of them in the Midwest, is they don't want to ever admit they're not perfect. I mean, they don't want anyone on the outside to see that their so-called dreamy look from the 1950s is not really what their city or state's all about. And I think that's one of their biggest problems, is they're in so much denial about what goes on in their states that they will do anything to cover it up to keep from ruining their image.
Ooh, that's a bad comment.
The truth.
I think it's an accurate comment. I think it's painful to accept, but I think there is an attitude in many communities all over the place that we don't need anybody from the outside telling us what we need to do. And also, there is, I think, an acute sense of embarrassment or shame or whatever you want to call it in unraveling a sordid mess. And this whole thing in Penn State has become just an unbelievably sordid mess for that place to deal with.
And you want to get into there. I know that, Peter, you feel strongly about the power politics of not wanting to invest. To embarrass Joe Paterno, the obsessive nature of football in College Station, in Happy Valley, excuse me, and I think that's a big factor. You get these small. Imagine Alabama and Birmingham and Tuscaloosa, where Alabama is such a strong force. Could you imagine anyone in that county admitting they were a problem? I just don't see it happening.
No, I don't see it happening. You know, I try to put myself back in the chain of events as we understand them to have unfolded, and you get McQueary viewing this incident in the locker room on what I understand to be a Friday night. Saturday morning, he's meeting with Coach Joe Paterno to relate what he has just seen the night before, and we have to assume from those facts that Paterno is getting a very detailed description of what's gone on, and McQueary is obviously very traumatized by this event. And then Paterno reports to, in effect, his superiors, who are, if I remember correctly, the vice president and or high-ranking members of the Penn State community. And after this report occurs, and you have to assume from these facts that the details were properly transmitted in a very short period of time, and yet after all that happens, very little is done, and you can't help but think at a high level people just wanted this to go away. They wanted to look the other way for a whole variety of reasons, some of which we've talked about, some of which we could probably spend hours talking about, but they all want it to just go away. And the end result is they basically tell Sandusky, don't come back on campus, and then they don't even do a very good job of enforcing that rule. They just want it all to go away.
But didn't this come to light in the 1990s?
Right. Well, let me clarify something for you. First of all, it wasn't just normal people. It was the athletic director, Tim Curley, and the vice president, Gary Schultz. And why is Gary Schultz important? Gary Schultz operated the campus police, who under Pennsylvania law have exclusive jurisdiction within Penn State. So the local sheriff has no jurisdiction on campus, and the only police on campus are controlled by the vice president, Gary Schultz. So this would be like reporting it to the chief of police and having the chief of police decide he wasn't going to tell anyone in his department.
Well, that's a very good point.
So that's the kind of cover-up it is. So that, to me, makes it worse. Recently, the governor said you know, Joe Paterno should have done more. Well, yes, he should have. He should have looked at his athletic director, who's his boss, the vice president, his boss, and said, you know, they have the ability to cover up, they are, and then he would have had to deal with the consequences of being a whistleblower, something everybody in his position has to deal with. So he was doing fine until he decided one day that he wasn't willing to blow the whistle, not only on Sandusky, but his immediate superior and the vice president of the university who controlled the local police. And so what we have here is another case of a university insulating itself from any criticism from the general public about anything they do, the handling of scholarships, the amount of endowments, how they spend it, what their tuition is, what they pay athletes, all the perks that go to all of them. They become self-contained corporations, and whether it's Karen Silkwood or someone in a current atmosphere, anyone under them is in danger of being either silenced, a cover-up, or dismissed and blackballed. And that's a problem that nobody's talking about. Do you disagree with me, Peter?
No, I agree 100%, and I'm grateful that you remembered the officials that he reported it to, because I knew it was the vice president, but I forgot it was also the athletic director. But either way, this is an inherent problem. I believe that this potential exists everywhere, but it's really powerfully dramatized here in Penn State, because these people ultimately have complete power over their community. And when you are faced with someone, you have complete power over your community, and you're faced with a very ugly situation, and you can either do the right thing, which could bring scandal and public scrutiny down upon you, or you can take the easy way out and just try to make it go away. Obviously there's a human problem here, and these people choose the lesser path. And I think that that's a potential that exists everywhere all the time, and it maybe even touches upon the other problems that we're discussing about with respect to school systems and how they deal with these problems. It's really pretty amazing. In retrospect, it looks very clear what people should have done, but I can tell you at that time, it seems very clear to me that these people, like, God, do we really want to – they really wrestled with it, and they chose the easier path.
This was the 1990s, and it went to the district attorney, and he decided not to do anything because I guess at the time there was only one boy that had stepped forward, and they decided that that wasn't enough evidence against Sandusky because he was a powerful guy. But it was first with the police department and the district attorney, right? Before it was...
I think there were other issues. There was the lack of cooperation from the university. There were all sorts of other things.
Yeah, but it goes back
very...
to the 1990s.
No, I'm talking about then, back in the 1990s, is there seems to be evidence, which is one of the things that's going to come out when the individuals are prosecuted, that they may well have squelched that investigation, either by lack of cooperation or some other act which had a material effect on it, because they are making motions right now to dismiss, Peter, and I understand that's the opposition to the motions, is that they participated in some act that caused the local sheriff not to do it. And I understand the local sheriff is extremely upset about it because he's now embarrassed by their conduct.
I'm sure everyone's going to be a little embarrassed when this is done. But I'm sorry, just for my clarification, who's moving to dismiss what exactly?
Tim Curley and Schultz have made motions to dismiss charges against them. And basically the opposition to this motion is centered around the fact that they conducted some willful act that ultimately resulted in this being delayed and not discovered.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I understand now what they're trying to do. I'm not sure I give it much chance of success, but I can see what they're trying to do now.
Well, I agree with you. But what it does is it's bringing the truth to the surface that the prosecutors, in some manner, believe that they have done something, some active conduct that they feel does not exculpate them from their actions. They somehow or another have done something that no one's disclosed completely in the press that's might be a little bit shocking to everybody later on.
Yeah, I suspect we have more surprises coming down the road here. And, something like this to be kept, Simon, your point, how come this took so long to explode is ultimately only going to magnify the actual explosion when it does occur. They sat on this for a long time, and I think the explosion is going to be even bigger than it's been so far, although we've probably seen the worst of it.
Well, I'm not sure you've seen the worst of it. If you look at the stuff coming out in the press, that there's a whole new deal going on with Penn State, asking for discovery in areas that do not involve anal penetration. Do any of you have any thoughts on the idea of, is it valid to go after the financial records
of the university?
Yes.
Of course I think they're valid, because that's usually where you catch everybody. Because of the nature of the university, they don't have offshore slush funds or whatever, and throwing the fact they can be incredibly arrogant about what they do, the simple fact is that you may well find a paper trail, and that paper trail could be quite revealing.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you agree? Yeah.
No, you want to take a look at the books and records and finances. You typically say in all these situations, follow the money, and first, Penn State's a public university, and I don't see how they can protect records that have any potential relevance at all. And one of the allegations that's going on here is that Sandusky's charity, and I always forget what it's called, 8 Mile or
Second
3 Mile, but they were making contributions to Penn State for a period of time here. There are issues regarding did people come forward or fail to come forward because of monetary incentives or reasons, and all this stuff is going to come out, and it's going to be the subject probably of lawsuits as well. civil lawsuits as well as criminal prosecution. So, you know, the whole thing is going to start to just slowly unravel here, no matter how hard they fight it.
Well, I know that some of the individuals who filed, some of the lawsuits have been filed, have been arguing that Penn State was active in concealment, and the fastest way to find that out is with the money, Simon, because the issue is, you know, did some of this occur because somebody was paid off? It's really a very, very simple question. Lawyers ask it every day, and you'll be shocked at how many times that is answered, yes, it's true, somebody was paid off, and that's why nobody heard about this sooner, and that's how we got to where we are. And I'm
right.
Sure that you've seen your share of that too, Peter.
Oh, absolutely. And it's sometimes it's not even as overt as, you know, sometimes it is very overt. I've seen situations where you literally, here's the check, and here's a copy of the check, and you're like, wow. But other times it's just, it's slightly more subtle ways. People get great salaries. Salaries go up. Incentives go up, and they're taken care of in other ways. And, of course, nobody wants to rock those boats or anything like that. And that's another form of active concealment.
Yes, I agree. So you have any comments on this, Nancy?
Well, no, I think the cover-up was for obvious reasons. And it's just too bad that it had to take from the 1990s to 2012 for this guy to go to trial. And there's so many more boys that were affected with the waiting, you know, having him not go to trial sooner and having it swept under the rug. It's just too bad that all the additional young boys that had to be abused by him, it could have all been prevented.
Nancy, you hit a really, really good button there. You know, it could have been prevented. What can we do to fix the education system?
And, you know, I also think with that McCreary guy, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly.
Yeah, you're right, McCreary.
Yeah, you know, if it was me and I was walking through a locker room and I saw an adult male or female forcing a, you know, child into some kind of sexual situation, I wouldn't just have walked through the locker room and then reported it the next day to my superior. I would have intervened and if, you know, pulled them off of the child. I would have done something immediately to protect the child in that situation. And I think that guy has to be brought to task for that. I mean, what's wrong with these people when they see children in danger where they just don't intervene? I don't understand.
Well, I can assure you that if I walked into a situation like that, I'd grab the nearest heavy object I could pick up, and I'd hit someone on the back of the head.
Yeah, of course, you would do anything you had to, but this guy, he does nothing, and the next day he reports it to Joe Paterno, and then that's it. He's fine. There's no charges brought against him. Everyone else, they're all supposed to be protecting the children except for him. He didn't have to jump in and help that boy. I don't understand that.
Well, you know, let me correct something. It's my recollection, and correct me if I'm wrong, Peter, that he actually went directly to Paterno at the time. It wasn't something he did later. It was something he did immediately.
Well, my understanding, is I read the summary of the grand jury indictment, and I read some articles about it. And my understanding is that he witnessed this after hours on a Friday night, and he was shocked and horrified by what he saw. And I think everyone wants him to have done more, but I also just should say, you know, from his point of view, he was also as strange and as horrible as this may sound. He was also a victim of a hostile work environment. You know, this was his work environment. This was his boss, and he saw something. And I do believe he was truly traumatized by it. It warped his world, and he was shocked. We would have liked him to do more. We certainly would have liked him to. Well, we would have liked him to do more, but I can tell you there are many people who see this, and I'm sorry to say they do nothing. He went home and he spoke to his father and was shocked and horrified and traumatized, and his father said, you have to report this. And then the next morning there was a meeting with Paterno. And yes, more should have been done, there's no doubt, but I've actually seen situations where people do nothing at all. They just fade into the background and they run away from this entirely. I don't want to punish somebody for at least doing something. We wish more, but I've seen too many
nowadays. Nobody wants to get involved. Nobody wants to help, their fellow human being. And it's like they always think instead of, helping somebody out, how is this going to affect me? They shouldn't think about that. They should just be more willing to help, especially when it's a child. I don't know how anybody could just walk by and allow abuse of a child to continue. I just don't understand that at all. I mean, I know people there are people that wouldn't even have said anything, but I don't like to say, let's give him some props because at least he said something. I think that's setting the bar really low. I think people should be more, inclined to actually have physically done something to stop what was happening at that point. I mean, throw a towel over the kid, walk the kid out of there, call the police at that point, do something. But just to have waited and to have to ask his father what to do, I mean, he's a grown man. Why does he even have to ask his father what to do? I don't know. I don't give him a pass. Maybe I'm harsh, but
You don't have to give him a pass. We don't. It's a horrible thing to be put in a situation like that. And I think everyone wants to think that they would do certain things when confronted with that. And hopefully we would all do more. But we never really know until we're actually confronted with it. And one of the problems in these types of circles is that there's an intense amount of hierarchy and loyalty. It's like the police department. It's like the military.
Right.
Football programs are very militaristic in terms of their sense of loyalty, sense we look out for each other, and it's a kind of pseudo military hierarchy. And this was his commanding officer, if you will. And I don't expect anyone to give him a free pass. But he had to contend in his mind with many conflicting things. And there's no doubt in my mind that at the moment he saw this, he was traumatized and was really paralyzed with respect. When you suffer a trauma, it disables your ability in part to make correct decisions, and it paralyzes you to a certain extent. Now, I know that seems strange and crazy, but I do believe that's an actual phenomenon. And I believe he was truly traumatized to it. I think the indictment of McQuarrie and the indictment of Paterno comes more in the weeks and months that pass. I think those are greater indictments of those two men because Paterno, to the same extent, was experiencing many of the same things, in my opinion. This is one of his beloved coaches. This is his team. And he himself may be conflicted. I don't want to rat on a guy. I don't want to send a guy to prison. I don't want to see him get killed in prison and die because he's a child molester. So even Paterno recognized that he had a conflict, and he went to his superiors and reported it. And basically, in the act of reporting it, said, look, I can't make this decision. You have to make this decision. But what's troubling about Paterno and McQuarrie is the weeks and months thereafter when they see that nothing's happening. And then they do nothing. And then I do think there's more of an affirmative duty to take greater steps. But they've become, they themselves have become set in a mindset where they thought, well, I've reported it. It's not my responsibility anymore.
Yeah, but they continue to the fact that this man was still left in situations where he was supervising young boys.
I know. And I think that's the real problem. That in weeks and months after this event occurred, it was obvious that nothing was going on. And it was also obvious that even though Sandusky had been essentially told that he couldn't have access to Penn State facilities anymore. He was still having access to Penn State facilities. It was kind of an unenforced rule. And he was still having access to young people, and he was still involved in his charity and interacting with Penn State. And that, to me, is a kind of a really hazy purgatory gray period where Paterno and McQueary had to be seeing Sandusky or hearing about him in one form or another. And
I have to break in. We're about to lose our live listeners. But fear not, folks. This is all being recorded. Okay.
Well, yeah, I agree. I want to add to something that, in furtherance to your conversation about the semi-military atmosphere, Sandusky and I are the same age. He had a brother who was a very successful professional football player, who I believe is in the Hall of Fame. These guys go back 15 years with Paterno, and in the case of McCreary, he was recruited by Sandusky. They had a father-son relationship. And to some extent, for Paterno at least, it was like being asked to report your child for a crime, something
right.
That a lot of parents would have a great deal of difficulty doing.
Right.
And in the case of McCreary, it would be like reporting his father for committing a crime, because he really considered Sandusky a second father to him throughout his years in school.
Yes.
And so what happens is you get these bad situations like this. But to me, the culprit that doesn't get blamed here is the culture of football and how Penn State University, as well as a lot of other universities, are capable of getting the local governments to enact laws that are favorable to them that allow them to get away with suppressing information like this, because to protect themselves, the state allows them to do these things. So why would the state ever want to allow any kind of group or university to have this unilateral power over themselves and be able to do exactly what we're discussing here? That really disturbs me. So, and then not only to have their own police force responsible to no one, which, as we know, there's nothing like unchecked power, because absolute power corrupts. And don't we have the classic example of absolute power corrupting? Would you agree with that one, Peter?
Oh, absolutely. And it reminds me of what we discussed earlier, is we have people essentially making decisions that this isn't alarming enough to go full out and set off all the alarm bells, whether it's in Calabasas or in Happy Valley. People with the ultimate decision authority are essentially saying, we don't think this is serious enough, and we're going to deal with it our way, not the best way.
No,
actually, what they're saying is this has too great of an impact upon our community to let it go public, is what I think they're saying.
Well, I think, yeah, that's true much more so with the Penn State issue.
Okay, Nancy, I could hear you grumbling in the background. You obviously have a comment.
I agree with what Manny was saying, and, you know, the community protects its own and all that other stuff, and people aren't alarmed. As I think that our culture is just jaded to a lot of things, and more things are acceptable, and, you know, it just goes to maybe the society falling apart and all these other bigger issues. But you never know what's in somebody's head and why they make the decisions they make. But I think it was not handled properly. But I wasn't running the show, so there wasn't a lot that I could have done about it. Had I been, it would have been handled differently. But
I think I'm with you on that one.
Yeah.
If I'd been running the show, someone would have been facing a big problem in the 1990s.
Yeah, and it sounded like a big bat too, right? You were going to grab the bat.
Oh, a very big bat.
Yes.
But, you know, this comes back to part of what is being said by Nancy, is the jaded part of our community. Our business community has become so overly protective about every aspect, and corporate America protects every little thing they do in such a way that it makes them actually dangerous to our, you know, democracy, because they have created what we study in law school as, you know, company-owned stores. Basically, they want to own a neighborhood, and they want to own everything that has to do with that neighborhood, and in the end, they want just total and complete control of everything.
Yeah. And that doesn't ever work out.
No,
it never works out.
So we've
gone
way over, Simon. We really, I don't know how much people want to call in and listen to the last 10 minutes of the show, but once again, we have just gone way out of it, which means we have wonderful, interesting guests, and we all have a lot to say, and I know we could do 4 hours on it, so you need to figure out when you want to cut us all off.
Well, I was just about to do that. I was going to go once around the table, yeah, to get everyone's final thoughts, and then indeed, you know, everyone is getting cut off. Let's start with Nancy. Nancy, do you have any final thoughts for us this week?
Well, I just think that on these topics, it's a shame that there isn't more community involvement and more personal involvement, where people are actually more tuned into what's happening around them. It's just amazing to me how in a world where we have all these little gadgets that, you know, work faster and more efficiently for us than our ancestors had back in their day, that nobody has time to get involved to help kids out. You know, it's just amazing.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. You know, I look back at, you know, when I was growing up, I didn't have a lot of gadgets and widgets. Yeah, but sure, I have fun.
Nothing personal there, Simon.
And this comes from somebody who just cannot put down the gadgets and widgets at this age. A computer lover, we hear saying that. And my last comment is, Simon, you may not be aware of this, but there was a story this week that comes up periodically in California about how California participated in this aggressive program to basically sterilize people who they thought were metal midgets, somewhat of the fresh from Nazi Germany policy on sterilizing people. And there's a few elderly in California who are still demanding some type of recompense for it. But the point is that we've had a problem in our country where the government has done way too much in this area and at the same time done too much to protect itself. And so here we are with a classic situation where we have a pedophile run loose because a school was so concerned with protecting itself, it did everything to prevent this from being public. And we as citizens need to look at our institutions, not trust them, and take greater action to protect ourselves, our children, and everyone from people in government and people in and pseudo- and quasi-governmental situations whose interest is perpetuating their jobs and their images and not the interest of the public. Peter, I'm passing it to you.
Yep.
Well,
Peter,
Manny,
your final thoughts.
Well, I really was thinking about the very same things that Manny closed with, which is that, you know, communities are ultimately just collections of individuals, and we all have to basically learn to depend upon ourselves to protect ourselves and to get people to do the right thing. And that starts with, you know, ourselves internally. We live in a world where everything that happens gets exposed sooner or later. And so we all have to try to live our lives accordingly. And if we want communities and institutions to behave a certain way, we all have to try to do it individually as well. And it's difficult, but that's what we have to strive for. And then the last thing that Manny said, I thought was very appropriate, is that we can't depend on these things to look out for us. We have to always exercise a certain amount of, you know, prevention and diligence on our own parts, because at the end of the day, there may be nothing else.
I want to thank you all for taking time to talk to me today. I think it's been a wonderful program, and let's do it again sometime soon.
Yeah, and I've got a request too. I'm going to file a lawsuit very shortly, Peter, that will be very, very interesting. And when it becomes a matter of public record, which you'll probably see it on the LA Times or and certainly on the news shortly, then we're going to have you back to comment on an interesting situation that involves lawyers and dishonesty. So don't make too many Sunday picnic plans because you will be
I won't. I live a very boring life. I'm pretty much available 24/7, and I look forward to reading about it. Congratulations.
Well, I don't know if it's congratulations. These always sadden me. So,
well, they're sad, but you're doing the right thing, it sounds like.
Yep.
Okay. Till next week. This is Simon Barrett, Manny Barling, wishing everyone a happy and safe life. Avoid us.
You sound like my wife.
Okay, next week. Goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.